Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Roadmap, an old school gaming podcast where we explore how the games of the past brought us the games we love today. This episode, we're going to be looking at the adventure game genre as a whole. Starting at the past, really at its early days, and looking at it how it evolved through the years and became the genre that we know and love today. Now, to start it all off, you really need to look at the core concepts of what an adventure game is. And at its fundamental basis, it is a story. It is taking you on an adventure. It is showing you the story of someone else. Whereas your shooters and your RPGs allow you to really build your own character or just be a template for you to project yourself onto, adventure games are predominantly stories of somebody else. You're getting to experience something you never would otherwise. For example, a space janitor or a cub reporter or Sherlock Holmes or something like that. That's really where this genre shines, is by letting you experience somebody else's story instead of projecting your own onto it. One of the more common elements, especially in the eras that I'll be covering mostly over the course of the series, are inventory and environment puzzles. So connecting inventory items together in ways that may not always make sense, or manipulating elements of the environment or using the inventory on the environment to really solve and advance the game. Pretty much every adventure game, it's going to involve interconnected scenes. Instead of moving smoothly through a focused environment like you would in, say, a first-person shooter, instead you're looking at these static scenes a lot of the time. Even if you can move around and get a different angle on them, they're still one room, essentially, that you're working around in. And they take a lot of time doing the world building. Because they're focusing on these scenes so much, it really allows them to kind of build out the world around them and flesh it out, and just those little details that are really going to help feel like this is a whole universe that exists out there. So for the sake of looking at adventure games, I've broken them down into some core eras of the genre. First off, we have our text-based section. From there, we're going to look at the text parser era, where there's the early graphic era of adventure games. Then we're going to look at the point-and-click section, where mice became much more useful in the interaction with it, both verb-based, and then we move on to the more icon-based, where it focuses heavier on the conversation. Take a brief look at kind of the dark years in between, and then look at the modern resurgence that's happened in the last decade or so, basically. So adventure games really started in computer gaming with text-based interaction, so all you had was really text on the screen. It would explain the scene that you're in. It would give you maybe a few little details about the world that's around you, and then give you the different directions you could go, like north, west, south, east. It really required a lot of imagination. It let you build the scene in your mind based on what it was telling you, and you could really see the origins of books and their influence on all this because it was just text. Now, this format uses a lot of small scenes that, when you look at them as a whole, they open up into a larger world, gives you a bigger sense of what's really going on. One of the things it does, if you're going to play it, maybe have some graph paper on hand to build out a map, because these games very, very much had a very grid map system in place, just because that's how you did it. You went in one direction, it moved you to a different scene. And it's really hard to landmark where you are unless you know it very, very, very well. Now, these games, a lot of the time, they would have an item gate just to make sure you don't go too far without completely screwing yourself over. One of the core games I would use to represent this era of it is Zork, Z-O-R-K. I mean, it's one that's become a classic for a reason. It's become incredibly well-known. And it had one of those elements in it where it had a forced light mechanic, where if you went into an area where it was dark and you kept exploring, you would be eaten by a creature. You would be killed just because they wanted to enact a sense of danger, and they also wanted to gate your progress. They wanted to kind of encourage you to really explore the environments that you had to make sure you found everything that you need. So they created basically an item gate where if you didn't have the lantern, you would die. Now, because it's kind of tedious to write out full phrases like go north or look 1,000 times in the course of a game, they did have little short codes that you could use in it a lot of the time. So L would be for look, N would be going north. This established what is going to be a little bit controversial later on in the genre, but you can lose, you can die, you can be forced to restart. And much of this genre does not have an autosave mechanic. So if you're ever playing an adventure game, that is where you will find in every single manual you look at. First tip on the list, save early, save often, and create multiple save game files just so you don't completely lock yourself in eventually. Now, as computers became more advanced, became more technically powerful, they started introducing graphics into this genre. And this is where you get, especially into the early Sierra games era. So games like King's Quest, Space Quest, Leisure Suit Larry. Now, instead of using just text to describe the scene, they would have a fully realized environment for you to be in. You'd have different screens you were going to. It's still very much going from one side to the other. Like, you're going north, you're going west, up, down, as the case may be. But every screen, instead of just a wall of text, it is now a realized scene. One of the other things with moving to graphics is they gave you a physical representation on the screen. You had a character now. For example, the Space Quest series, it had Roger Wilco, Space Janitor. And you would move that character around. And instead of it being some non-existent character that is your perception of it, it now has a character, a bit of a personality, a bit of a animation to it where you can really see who the character is. Moving around is done, obviously, with the arrow keys at this point. So instead of standing in one spot and being go north, you're now able to move around the scene to interact with it. You need to be close to the items you want to interact with. At this point, interaction was still very much based on entering text. And they developed text parsers for this. They basically pulled them from the text-based era. So you would have to tell it to interact with something. You would have to tell it to do something. This allowed the developers to have a little bit of fun in the game design, because if you swore at them, it would usually have a witty response to come back at you, because they know what the kind of thing the players are going to do. The other nice thing is, because things are more technically powerful, because they had really spent time developing the text parsers over the years, it allowed for more complex phrases. You could give it more complex directions so that you could get more complex puzzles, use a little bit more logic to the puzzles. As the graphic era evolved a little bit and mice became much more common with computers, we move into a point-and-click type environment where instead of walking to a location with the arrow keys, you're now able to just click on the screen to walk to where you want to go to. This is where LucasArts really becomes a defining element of all this, because they have games like Maniac Mansion and Monkey Island where you're no longer typing in any phrases. You're using a list of actions on the screen. So you have look at, open, close, walk to, talk, all those things to allow you to interact on the screen. It allowed them more control over the puzzles and over the environment. So what you would do is you would click on an action, then you would click on somewhere on the screen, either on an NPC or an item. That would really give you a chance to interact better with the scene. The other nice thing about that is that they started representing the inventory. You would physically see your inventory on the screen instead of it just being a list during the text parser eras. So now you didn't just have a word named wallet on the screen. You would actually see a wallet there that you could look at, and it would tell you a little bit about the wallet. The nice thing is we're starting to get into better graphics now. The graphics are getting a little more advanced. Resolutions are getting stronger. So you can do a lot more on the screen. You can show a lot more in your scene. You can get a little bit more detail in there. The big downside with the point-and-click era, once that started, is that it kind of created pixel hunting for certain items. So instead of just saying, get the dog, you would now have to hover around the screen, try and find the right section of the screen to click on to interact with said dog. And depending on how complex the scene gets, depending on how involved the scene gets and how much items are on the screen, this can be a big, big headache to play with. Now, as the point-and-click era evolved more, it moved from verb-based interactions to icon-based interactions. So now you would have an eyeball to represent look. You would have a hand to represent get, use, open, interact, walking symbol, like a walk sign from a traffic light to represent walk. This made it a little bit easier to go. You'd have five or six icons that you kind of click on throughout the course of the game. Usually you can rotate through those using your right mouse button versus before, where you'd have to go down, click that, move back up onto the screen. You can kind of stay on the screen and click into what you need to. This is where the inventory screen, having a graphical inventory screen, became even more involved, because you could add those few in. You could add, say, a look or a use or a combine option on your inventory screen. Now you're getting even more detailed information about the wallet. If you looked at a wallet, you could open it up, maybe find a card in there or something. It just allowed more interaction. It allowed the world to feel more real. And as part of keeping the world more real, you're going to get into it creates conversation puzzles and conversation trees. So before, if you talk to a character before this era, you might get a quick phrase off them, you might get a little bit of information off them, but you're not going to get a deep conversation, you're not going to be able to crawl through a conversation tree and find information. And this allowed for more puzzles based on text, and say, if you found certain items, you could ask them about those items, that would open up more dialogue options and really help you, really encourage you to interact with the world even more. At the back end of the 90s, the adventure genre started to peter off a lot. It effectively died for a while. For years, the death knell of the genre was hailed as Grim Fandango from LucasArts, which, a phenomenal game, great game, I love it. But it seemed to come out at the wrong time. It was a very 3D adventure game. It had what was called tank control, so instead of pointing in a using a direction would move you in that direction, it would turn you. So if you went, if you were using WASD, A would turn you left, D would turn you right, W would go forward, S would go backwards, but in relation to how the character was facing. I don't think that was a big aspect of why the genre started dying out at that time. I think it was more a movement towards shooters, a movement towards an increased narrative in games that didn't typically have a narrative at the time. And for the most part, it dropped off. Adventure games died. Adventure games disappeared. You had a few holdouts in this era, a few torchbearers that held up during this interim dark ages, such as Siberia. You had the Longest Journey series, which was both Longest Journey, Dreamfall. Frogware's Sherlock Holmes games really helped carry the torch during this era because they included both first-person and third-person sections, and they included a quality-of-life feature that I loved, where you could highlight what you could interact with on the screen. So if you're really stuck, if you're really trapped, you can click your interaction and go, okay, I hadn't dealt with that yet. In the mid-2000s, kind of early 2010s, we started seeing new games coming out from the adventure series. We started seeing remasters of classics. We started seeing new sequels of classics that hadn't come out before, and the developers that had used to work for these big companies had spun off into their own and really fought to get their licenses back so they could follow up on these stories they always wanted to tell. This is where we start seeing the Monkey Island remastered. We start seeing new Sam & Max games. Recently, we've seen a new King's Quest series come out, and the big team on the forefront of all this has been Telltale Games. They really embraced it. They did one or two small-scale games before they really got a hands on the license, almost as a way to show what they could do. And then they got a hands on the license. A lot of Telltale's founders were old LucasArts staff, so they really fought to get those old LucasArts license backs. So that's why you saw them do a new Sam & Max franchise. You saw them do a new series of the Monkey Island games. And those early games, the early games from Telltale, really embraced the classic style. They were very much sequels, right down to the inventory puzzles, right down to the dialogue trees, right down to the sense of humor. Now, when Telltale started, they really focused on trading on the nostalgia from before, which is not a criticism, considering most of them were trading on nostalgia that they had created in the beginning. As time moved on, they did become their own creature, and they've really helped bring the adventure genre into what it is now, which is less a focus on inventory puzzles, obscure, esoteric puzzles, and more of a focus on the choices that you make, and it really brings it right back to its roots of telling a story and really letting you focus on experiencing somebody else's story, which is, I think, a beautiful thing. It's a little bit different, but it's not a bad thing by any means. When you're talking about the different style of adventure games that are out there, I personally tend to break them down into three different types. So you have your Sierra games, your LucasArts, and your Telltale. It's not to say those are the only three companies out there that make games, but they are the three that kind of define the styles. So the best way to look at it is to kind of break it down. You have Telltale, which is the modern one. They focus very much on choice in the game. It makes changes to the story. It lets you experience it differently. Really gives you a reason to go back and play it again so you can see what my choice would have done otherwise for it and really get a sense of what's going on. Sierra, their focus is on the puzzles. They focus very heavy on the puzzles. Sierra will also set you up for good deaths, because you can fail those games, you can die at random points, you can do something stupid and pay a price for it. The nice thing is Sierra usually kept those somewhat humorous to an extent. So yeah, you're going to die, but you're going to laugh about it when it happens. LucasArts took a very different approach to that for most of their games. They believed in a very deathless style. It's very hard to lose the game. You're not going to be able to kind of get yourself painted into a corner like you can with the Sierra games. And I've got an excerpt here from the Sam & Max manual that the game we're going to be focusing on next episode that really encapsulates their philosophy on that design. We believe that you buy games to be entertained, not to be whacked over the head every time you make a mistake. So we don't bring the game to a screeching halt when you poke your nose into a place you haven't visited before. Unlike conventional computer adventures, you won't find yourself accidentally stepping off a path or dying because you've picked up a sharp object. We think you'd prefer to solve the game's mysteries by exploring and discovering, not by dying 1,000 deaths. We also think you like to spend your time involved in the story, not typing synonyms until you stumble upon the computer's word for a certain object. Now, it wouldn't be an episode of Digital Roadmap without talking about manuals. Adventure game manuals are phenomenal. They aren't necessarily long, but some of the best ones out there are going to give you a sense of the environment. It's a really great chance to show off the world you're in, the universe that you're in. You get games like Laura Bow has a museum guide instead of a manual, and that'll give you a breakdown of all the different things going on. It's a great way to introduce you to the characters that you're going to be interacting with in the game. Sam & Max does a road travel guide, which, go figure, I'm a little biased towards. But it gives you an in-universe feel. It doesn't just say, click start to start a new game. I mean, it does do that, but it's not the focus of it. In terms of the world of manuals, I find adventure games have some of the best in-universe design manuals. Manuals that are written from the perspective of the world you're playing in. So you have Lorebo 2, the Dagger of Amun-Ra, had their manual as a museum guide. It would tell you all about the museum that you're going to be spending most of the game in to give you a sense of that world, and they would slip in descriptions of, you know, certain mechanics in the game, certain ways to interact with it, but it still felt very much like the world. The other thing adventure games really embraced, especially in the 90s before we had modern DRM, you had online verifications, is it used copy protection within the manual itself. So Lorebo, which I mentioned before, it would have a list of Egyptian gods and goddesses and what each one would do, and you would be quizzed on that at some point in the game, and you would have to answer appropriately to prove that you own the game, to prove that you had the manual there with you. Another good one was Space Quest IV, Roger Wilco and the Time Rippers, included the futuristic version of numbers and information. You would have to take the information you were given in the game, go back to the manual, translate it into these random symbols, and type that into a computer. Yes, these were a way to make sure people aren't bootlegging the game, that you actually own the game because you have the manual to go with it, but I found it a great way to just kind of build the universe again in the manual and just have a full fleshed out universe around it. Now, if I had to give a recommendation for the different eras that I've covered in this episode, for the text-based era, I would recommend Zork as a prime example of the genre. If you really want to torture yourself, I would recommend maybe checking out Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from that era. For the early graphic for the text parser era, I would absolutely recommend either Space Quest or King's Quest from Sierra Games. They embody it, they embrace it, they are some of the best examples. For the early point-and-click, for the verb-based point-and-click, Monkey Island would be the best one, I think, to go with, the first Monkey Island game. It's got a great sense of humor. It's not too punishing, like something like Maniac Mansion is. As a prime example of the Icon era, I would say either Space Quest IV or Sam and Max Hit the Road, which, again, we're going to be covering in the next episode. During the quote-unquote dark period, I would definitely say Grim Fandango. It is a beautiful game. It's got some great style to it. In terms of Frogwares, I would probably recommend Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper, just a great spin on alternative fiction. And for Telltale, really anything that they've done in recent years, so they're best known right now for the Walking Dead franchise. Season 3 just started up. I would say go play the Walking Dead ones if you're a fan at all of the franchise. Even if you're not, it'd be a great game to check out. Just a reminder for anybody going back to play the older games, anything from the Icon-based era or earlier, the inventory puzzles don't always follow logic. A lot of the time they were there just to frustrate you and make you keep playing the game and not blow it out of the water in the course of a day. Have some patience. Please, please try and solve the puzzles yourself before you go consulting a guide. That being said, don't feel ashamed if you have to go get a guide. But do make sure you have the manuals in some form or another, because they are going to be lifesavers. Sometimes the manual will even give you the solution to a puzzle without you realizing it's giving you the solution. They're there for a reason. Please read the manuals. They're always phenomenal resources to have. And that's it for this episode of Digital Roadmap. I know it was a bit of a shorter episode. The even numbers always are. It's a bit more of a broad look at a topic as opposed to the deep dives we do in the odd number episodes. Next episode is going to be Sam and Max Hit the Road from LucasArts. It's a great adventure game from the Icon era that we were talking about. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast from. Drop a review on there so we can get better at the show. Feel free to reach out to me on Twitter @RoadmapPodcast. Maybe suggest some old games we can play. Maybe share your favorite stories of adventure games you played growing up. And thanks again for listening.